Today's reading is an excerpt from Ralph Waldo Emerson's The Divinity School Address, in which he describes something that is not vibrant, open, or inspirational. Whenever the pulpit is usurped by a formalist, then is the worshiper defrauded and disconsolate. We shrink as soon as the prayers begin, which do not uplift, but smite and offend us. We are fain to wrap our cloaks about us and secure as best we can a solitude that hears not. I once heard a preacher who sorely tempted me to say, I would go to church no more. Men go, thought I, where they are wont to go, else had no soul entered the temple in the afternoon. A snowstorm was falling around us. The snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral, and the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him, and then out of the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. He had lived in vain. He had no one word intimating that he had laughed or wept, was married or in love, had been commended or cheated or chagrined. If he had ever lived and acted, we were none the wiser for it. The capital secret of his profession, namely to convert life into truth, he had not learned. Not one fact in all his experience had he yet imported into his doctrine. This man had plowed and planted and talked and bought and sold. He had read books. He had eaten and drunken. His head aches. His heart throbs. He smiles and suffers. Yet was there not a surmise, a hint in all the discourse that he had ever lived at all? Not a line did he draw out of real history. The true preacher can be known by this, that he deals out to the people his life, life passed through the fire of thought. But of the bad preacher, it could not be told from his sermon what age of the world he fell in, whether he had a father or a child, whether he was a freeholder or a pauper, whether he was a citizen or a countryman, or any other fact of his biography. It seemed strange that the people should come to church. It seemed as if their houses were very unentertaining, that they should prefer this thoughtless clamor. It shows that there is a commanding attraction in the moral sentiment that can lend a faint tint of light to dullness and ignorance, coming in its name and place. The good hearer is sure he has been touched sometimes, is sure there is somewhat to be reached, and some word that can reach it. When he listens to these vain words, he comforts himself by their reflection, by their relation to his remembrance of better hours, and so they clatter and echo unchallenged. And now let us do what we can to rekindle the smoldering, nigh-quenched fire on the altar. The evils of the church that now is are manifest. The question returns, what shall we do? Let the breath of new life be breathed by you through the forms already existing. For if once you are alive, you shall find they shall become plastic and new. The remedy to their deformity is first soul and second soul and third evermore soul. And now we'll have special music by Sabrina Bowker.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sabrina. That was beautiful. Now we will sing hymn number 100, I've Got Peace Like a River.
Personally, I can't sing that one without moving. Now, if you listen to the wonks who study church and religious groups in America, you hear doom and gloom. Fewer than a quarter of people attend religious services as often as 3 out of 8 weeks. Mainline churches, that is the Episcopal, Congregationalist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, United Methodist, have long since been written off as failing organizations, declining membership, all that. Even the more conservative churches seem to be in trouble. Southern Baptists are in decline. There aren't as many megachurches as there were at the beginning of the century. Even the Mormons are losing members. Now, they are actually probably growing at about the same rate as the population increase, but oh well. And there are a few groups growing, non-denominational churches, Assemblies of God, Muslims, Hindus. But for the most part, religious participation in America seems to be in precipitous decline. And I know it might not look like that from here in Middle America, but the trends are clear. The fastest growing group, you guessed it, the nones, N-O-N-E-S, nones, those who do not identify as anything religiously. They went from 16 to 23% of the adult population between 2007 and 2014. So in 7 years, they grew from 16 to 23%. Now, some of them identify theologically as atheist or agnostic, but most of them just say that they're nothing in particular. And strangely, a significant minority of them says that religion is important in their lives. Researchers and church people are falling all over themselves to account for this odd turn of affairs. The best comment I found was from L. Gregory Jones, senior strategist for leadership education at Duke University in North Carolina, who said, "Millennials are less atheists than bored." Now, to be fair, he put an if in front of that, so it's more theory than documented fact, but I think he's on to something. A lot of people today, especially younger people, look at religious communities and yawn. The theology mystifies them. The attitudes about gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people seem totally out of touch. The ritual is senseless. And meanwhile, they see a world that is scarred and scary, violent, violence, misuse of power, inequality, poverty. And they ask, didn't Jesus say something about that? Why isn't the church doing something? And they explore the religious landscape. They try yoga or meditation, read Paulo Coelho, or listen to the Dalai Lama's podcasts. They learn Taizé chants, get tarot cards read, or throw coins and interpret them with the I Ching. They're looking for something. They're not finding it in traditional religion, and that's why they are nuns. It's not new, this impatience with establishment religion. It precipitated religious reform efforts from the Reformation to Wesleyanism to Sufism to Wahhabism. Each offers its particular analysis and prescriptions. The Reformation liberalized Christian theology, decreasing the power of the establishment. The Wesleys introduced piety and small group discernment into ritualized Anglicanism. The Sufis found a mystical strain in Islam, while the Wahhabis asserted a return to conservative principles. So reforms can be conservative or liberal, can focus on ideas, emotions, or actions. They can change music or worship or theology. They can urge a return to the fold or setting out on a new path. What they have in common is that they are exciting. They inspire people. And we are at a time when reform is demanded. We have had our own particular reform movement in Unitarian Universalism, and that was Transcendentalism. The Transcendentalists grew out of Unitarianism in the middle of the 19th century in reaction to what Emerson once called corpse-cold Unitarianism. Some of the Transcendentalists abandoned Unitarianism, leaving religion that they had been born into, and others stuck it out, fortunately, as our movement ended up deeply influenced by them. Emerson himself took a middle course, quitting his pulpit at Second Church in Boston when he no longer felt he could give communion with integrity. Though he kept speaking at Unitarian churches and maintained his affiliation. And here are his words about his resignation. He said, "I have sometimes thought that in order to be a good minister, it was necessary to leave the ministry. The profession is antiquated. In an altered age, we worship in the dead forms of our forefathers." Emerson did not mince words. Marissa read excerpts this morning from his Divinity School address that was given in 1838 at Harvard Divinity School to the graduating class. And as you heard, he did not much care for what he saw going on in churches, at least those he was familiar with. He felt defrauded and disconsolate as a worshiper. The events outside the window were more compelling for him than what he heard from the pulpit. Now, to be fair, in Unitarian churches and in UU churches still today, a lot of us have windows that people can look out of when they're bored. I think about the one of the hardest places in the world to preach must be at the Church of the River in Memphis, where you stand, there's this huge window behind you that looks out on the Mississippi. And you think, why would anybody be paying any attention? They're just going to watch the Mississippi go by. But, you know, maybe that's a good way to spend a Sunday morning. Anyway, this idea that what's outside the windows is more compelling than what's going on inside the room, I think most of us have felt that way one time or another. It's a common feeling today in many different religious groups. And after Emerson gave that talk, he was not invited back to Harvard again until his dotage. They didn't care to hear anything more from him. The Divinity School address started a controversy that raged in the press and deeply influenced what he wrote in his famous essay, Self-Reliance, about ignoring the voices around you who are critical. In general, the Transcendentalists, and in particular Emerson, did not want to give up on religion. They did, though, want it to be more vibrant, open, and inspirational. That's also what the nuns want today, and what we as a fellowship have committed to. And in talking about this aspect of the vision statement, that's where I'm looking to, is to those two sources, to the Transcendentalists and to the searching of the contemporary nuns. So what did the Transcendentalists bring into religion? Deeply influenced by the Romantic movement in Europe, they extolled the world of nature, nature with a capital N. Emerson's reference to the snowstorm in the words we heard this morning illustrate that. And in the same address, that Divinity School address, he spoke about the blowing clover as the true miracle, while stories of turning water into wine he labeled as monster. No wonder he didn't get invited back. Remember Thoreau's Walden? More transcendentalist, nature-loving. God, for them, was more outside, but also inside human nature, in nature, than in church. And so they were looking for something beyond that biblical teaching that was going on. And they easily accepted the controversial historical critical interpretation of the Bible that was arising in Germany. And at the same time, they discovered truth in non-Christian sources. They read the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran. And in the final decade of the 19th century, when Swami Vivekananda brought Hinduism to the U.S., it was the Transcendentalists like Jenkin Lloyd Jones who paved his way. Transcendentalists did more than speak about their beliefs in their salons and their journals. They embraced action to change the world, abolitionism, feminism, and utopian communities. Unitarian minister Theodore Parker wrote his sermons with his gun by his side to defend the fugitive slaves who he was hiding. Bronson Alcott and George Ripley started communal farms. Margaret Fuller became the first female foreign correspondent. Champions of reason, they also wanted religion to be felt, intuited. Unitarianism, they thought, had become too sensible as it resisted the extremes of the Second Great Awakening, which was an evangelical movement. Transcendentalists wanted to experience the holy, to feel it, rather than just opine about it. Emerson talked about the oversoul, that vital, universal force in which all souls participate. Some have compared it to the Hindu concept of Brahman. Feeling the connection to the natural world, to one another, to everything mattered more than ideas did. And in their openness, Transcendentalists did not expect that others agree with them, or even that they agree with one another. Their arguments excited them as much as their agreements. Don't follow me, declared Emerson. Find your own path. Now, admittedly, building institutional structures on such radically open ideas may be impossible, at least a challenge. Remember, many of the Transcendentalists either left Unitarianism or never affiliated with it at all. So their ideas and ideals, though, persisted in Unitarianism to this day. Still, we are deeply attracted to nature, open to truth from all religions, committed to social change, and open to a wide variety of ideas, just like the Transcendentalists. A few years ago, a minister thought that we needed to launch a neo-transcendentalist movement. If it didn't have so many syllables, I would tend to agree with him. But neo-transcendentalism is just not a slogan that I think is going to catch on. What's more, there are plenty of folks out there, though, who need that orientation, who want it. And yet, as an association of congregations, we're stagnant. We have roughly the same number of congregations we did when the Unitarians and Universalists merged in 1961, and a bit fewer children and adults, a little north of 200,000. And that's according to numbers reported by the congregations to the Unitarian Universalist Association. So they ought to know how many Unitarians there are. But surveys of how people identify tell us that there are 586,000 UUs as of 2008. That means that there are more than 2.5 times as many people who identify as UU as there are members of our congregations. Why aren't they in our congregations? Well, I don't have any data, but I have anecdotes. I have friends who were once very regular UUs in a particular congregation. They were leaders of small groups, involved in a ministerial search. It's a married couple. They were strong givers in time and money. They moved to a new state, and they found themselves spending a lot of weekends camping and hiking. And they tried out the two congregations near them and didn't, even though they gave it a good try, 6 months or more, and didn't find the same connections and community that they had felt in their home church. Instead, they began meeting with a small group that was interfaith, where their spiritual explorations went deep, and they spent their weekends soaking up nature. And if asked in a survey if they're UU, I'm betting they'd say yes. At one level, there's nothing wrong with that. I think, though, it's an example of how the congregations they encountered didn't feel as open, vibrant, and inspirational as what they'd left behind. They didn't get engaged, and they could have. UUs without congregations are not the only people that I think need us. Remember those nuns? Many, though not all of them, want to explore religiously and spiritually. They don't want to be nailed down with doctrine. They want to be able to assemble their own ideas and inclinations. And what's more, surveys tell us that in mainline churches, only 49% of the members describe themselves as absolutely committed to Christianity. Slightly more are willing to try a new church. Two-thirds, 67%, are open to pursuing faith in environments or structures that are different from those of the typical church. Almost three-quarters, 72%, say they are more likely to develop their own religious beliefs than to adopt those taught by the church. Less than half of them contend that the Bible is accurate in the life principles it teaches. All that to say that there are plenty of people who would be attracted by an open, vibrant, inspirational congregation. People who already identify as UU, people who see themselves as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular, and people who are in more traditional churches, but not quite in line with the doctrine and dogma there. So, I've said a fair amount about why we want to be vibrant, open, and inspirational, and not much about how. So first, let me say that I think this congregation has a fair amount of vibrancy, openness, and inspiration. I've been deeply touched by the talks that people, the personal reflections that people have given, like Sylvia's this morning. I think that says something about who we are and how we are. We have more of a range of ages than many congregations do, and that's a sign and symptom of vibrancy. We're active and involved in community. We're willing to take risks. Sorry. And we have nice music. At the same time, I've heard more than one committed member say that they don't care much about the Sunday morning service, the central event of our congregational life. And that's hard to hear. And that tells me that we're not vibrant and inspirational enough. And to achieve this piece of our vision, we have to be willing to let go of what we do and how we do it. And I'm speaking as much to myself in that as anyone else. We have to be ready to explore and experiment. And we're going to see a short video here in just a minute. I think that the UUA has acknowledged the challenge that we have in terms of needing to explore and experiment so that we can try to be more inspirational.
Well, they're working on that. Talk about our little activity we did earlier. Did you learn new things about people that surprised you? What about Minecraft?
It was like an emerging thing when I was in middle school, and kids are still playing it.
Yeah. And say, I know of one adult in the congregation who plays Minecraft. Did anyone discover an adult? Can I out her? Kathy Hedge plays Minecraft. Did everyone find the entomologists in our group? Would the entomologists like to raise their hands?
When I came here, one of the things I realized is there were more entomologists in this congregation than I had ever met before.
Unitarian Universalists know as well as anyone that our religious landscape is changing. Though people need our faith as much as ever, they're less likely to participate in traditional forms of religion. So we need lots of new forms.
Emerging ministries are any group, project, or endeavor that is grounded in our faith and brings people together in covenanted and intentional ways. Emerging ministries take many forms, one road, many lanes. Some of our emerging ministries are congregations, like Sacred Path.
Sacred Path is called to heal and transform the world, one act of love at a time. Sacred Path members take our voices and hands into the world by singing in prisons and marching for racial justice, by cultivating community gardens and organizing neighborhood peace festivals.
Some are campus ministries, like the UUs of the College of Worcester.
As emerging adults enter the world, they are in need of a welcoming community, the provides a safe space to ask questions, to discover who they are and what they believe.
Some of our emerging ministries are multi-site, like the cluster that makes up Oak Ridge, Tennessee Valley, Foothills, and Westside UUs.
The work is not about preserving the institution. The work is about figuring out how to be inspired, uplifted, on fire, generous, and radical instruments of the holy. Institutions may crumble, but love never fails.
Some are missional communities, like Sacred Fire.
Sacred Fire UU is co-creating ways for us to be in relationship with those who share our vision of the beloved community, but who aren't seeking church. Our ministry's central mission is truly to give life the shape of justice.
Some of our emerging ministries are meeting groups, like Create Meaning.
Our Create Meaning program taught us a lot about what we need to do to be able to reach others who are spiritual but not religious, so that people could see our way of religion as part of the larger cultural milieu that is the new American religious landscape.
And some are hybrids, like the Sanctuaries in Washington, D.C.
The Sanctuaries is an artist collaborative that focuses on social justice issues. There is something truly spiritually deep about connecting with other people and creating together. And it just seems so simple, but it's definitely spiritual, and it's definitely something that connects us to community and to one another.
The Unitarian Universalist Association is ready to support emerging ministries. Staff from every region and multiple departments are working together to bring resources and expertise to these new groups and projects. We are learning as we go in this holy work, co-conspiring with that fierce love that connects us to one another as we bring more wholeness, connection, and justice to our world.
So when we say we want to be open, vibrant, and inspirational in what we say and do, I want to encourage big ideas, even if they're outside what we might expect. Taking real risk, strategic risk, risk that follows and enhances our mission, we don't change our substance, which is a belief in openness, reason, and improving our world. And that leaves us lots of room to maneuver. We can learn from everyone. For example, evangelicals in recent years have been talking about remaking worship to be epic. That is experiential, participatory, image-rich, and connected. And those adjectives evoke the world we live in today. We crave experience and participation over being weighed down with information and arguments. We long for story more than evidence, and pictures, images more than words. You know, think about that picture of the polar bear on the melting ice. That communicated more about global warming and popularized the movement against it more than piles of scientific documentation. As human beings, we resonate with images and impressions and may even use our words to paint stories and pictures, to create excitement. Making changes, shaking up systems, opening our ways of being to critique not only feels risky, it is risky. We have to recognize that risk can lead to failure. Be sure to be prepared for that. But taking small risks may lead to learning better how to use risk and change in our congregational lives and in our personal lives as well. Risk may be dangerous to play with, but the greatest risk is often making no change at all as the world changes around us. If we're to keep adapting to a world that moves faster and faster, where communication links us in ways unimaginable only a moment ago, then sometimes we have to set aside what has been comfortable and consider what is new. We may need to be open to ideas from sources that surprise us and to adopt the attitudes of our transcendentalist forebears who brought unimaginable change to a young movement that evolved into Unitarian Universalism. Settling for the status quo is not enough because we can do better. And plenty of people, that next generation of UUs, which is not only our children but also people who will come to us from another place, need us. And in resonance with that idea of taking risks and opening up, I'm going to open up to questions and comments.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm Kathy Hedge. I was thinking back to Cecil Miller and a long time ago when we were in the little room back there, and how we were really struggling with the idea of possibly getting some ministerial help. And as I listened this morning and heard the quote, let's see, what was about the Emerson saying that we needed a person who could fill, who could take, you know, the religion and filter it through their life experience, and then share that with us. And so when I heard that, I just felt, thank you for John Alou. I'm so glad you're with us.
Jessica Severs. I think I've grown a lot more in this congregation because I've been terrified but willing to take risks in front of everyone in their presence. And I feel like not only do I earn so much back from feedback when I share, or, you know, have the opportunity to listen to somebody else's talents or their stories, and that really just gets you here. But this is a safe place for that, and I feel like we can all be so open and welcoming. And I'm always surprised at the connections you can make, because it's nothing you ever expect. But I think that quote you said last week, the risk and growth and learning, that totally happens almost every time we have somebody share their personal stories. And I think that those personal stories really help connect all of us together.
What I've always felt was kind of interesting about this place, and Reverend John Lee reminded me, is that, you know, we sort of promote diversity, or try to incorporate diversity as a way of finding common ground, and I've always thought that that sort of juxtaposition was interesting and inspiring. And it's sort of the way we do that, I feel like, is we try to sort of clear away, it sort of makes you clear away all the baggage that that obstructs you from understanding the other opinion, so to speak. So sort of diversity to get to common ground.
Kelly Richardson McBee. One of the things that, since coming here, it's really, I used to be very involved and active in smaller groups and emerging ministry type groups. I will say that being here has made me more aware of the need for my children to grow up in a more interfaith type of situation, and come forth from a single religious viewpoint to one that is mindful and respectful of all different viewpoints. It's also reignited in me the desire for more social justice opportunities, if not in large groups, but one-on-one helping. And I think that's something that's I'm very thankful for with this congregation.
You tell me when.
I will.
Michael Littlefather, a number of years ago, I went to the first fall meeting of the third Unitarian congregation that I belonged to, the Fellowship of Athens, Ohio. And the president of the congregation had no minister. He opened this service back in the day when lots of Unitarian and Universalist churches did not have summer meetings, and so this was the first meeting of the fall, and he said, I want to welcome guests here. We don't have much ritual here, but we do have some routine. Now, I think lots of people did not get it, what he was saying there. And I hope as we try all this other stuff that we retain at least enough routine that we can have some expectation of what we will get before the morning is over, but with spiced by innovation and the rest, but a little bit of ritual.
Sybil Perkins, this is our fourth Unitarian congregation we've been members of, I think, fourth. All four in college towns. Mm-hmm. None of them had really a strong on-campus presence. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that is or what's involved in making that happen. It just seems like young adults in that age bracket are very, you know, in that explorational self-discovery phase, mm-hmm. and we it just seems like a good place for our presence.
I don't disagree with that. I think that's absolutely true. And when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, actually, we did have a vital student ministry going when I was there. And part of it was because the First Unitarian Society had a half-time position that was committed to outreach on campus. 'Cause it's hard to maintain energy in a campus ministry without having, you know, somebody who's really paid and dedicated to doing it, because the students come and go, and their levels of energy come and go through the semester in a pretty predictable way. So, but I agree with you. I think that's really true.
Ann Cowan here. My first association with UU attracted me because it sounded like it could possibly be exciting. It was in Albion, Michigan, and there was a group that wanted to form a fellowship there. Someone from Boston came to help us, and we were told, we got a meeting room in a local hotel and told to come in the back door and up the back steps and not advertise what we were doing. And that immediately attracted me to the whole deal.
We're doing something subversive here.
Bryce Hobrock, in a presentation that I made week before last to the ECM book study group up at St. Thomas More, not many of people know it exists, but it's a group of people from just about all different persuasions in religion. The thing that stood out in that particular chapter that I was presenting, which was titled Atheism, actually, but the thing that has attracted people over thousands of years in congregating in a sense like this is ritual and community. That was made very clear because there is comfort in ritual, coming together where you can all do the same thing at the same time, and then obviously the community aspect that we have here. What we're swimming upstream against, however, is current popular culture and media in which we are inundated, where everything has to be noisy, slam-bang, explosive, inspirational. We're adopting this inspirational, and that's what's going on. If it's not inspirational and loud, why, people won't come. So I'm somewhat on the edge of how we deal with my own desire for quiet and the noisy.
And having that balance, and I think part of what people come to religion for too sometimes is the quiet. is the, okay, let me still my mind. I mean, that's what we see over and over again in different traditions where we look at meditation and prayer and that kind of thing. Part of it is, how do I get quiet and an opportunity to step back and away from the world? So let's let this be the last comment.
Just a quick response to Sybil. There was a pagan group on campus that morphed into the Organization for the Exploration of Religious Alternatives or something along, or the Understanding of Religious Alternatives. And I don't know what's happened to those, but I was a faculty advisor for them for a while, and that was kind of fun. Anyway, if anybody knows anything, that'd be great.
Okay. Well, let's join together in singing in a rousing way, if possible. Come and Go With Me, number 1018. Stand as willing and able. Transcendentalist Theodore Parker, be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space, its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living. So might it be.